No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them.
Okay, folks, well, welcome to a special edition of the Contrivia podcast. We are going to be premiering, as we had mentioned in a previous podcast, our exclusive interview with Noam Chomsky. So I wanted to just real quick kind of give a quick intro here to, you know, a little bit about who Chomsky is. You know, basically Chomsky, I mean, he's like 84 years old now. He is become one of the, you know, for decades now, one of the world's leading sort of critics and analysts of U.S. foreign policy and dissidents of, you know, American power and American human rights abuses in the world. Highly respected, you know, world famous guy, but a virtual unknown in terms of American mainstream media. You know, as well respected as he is, you will never see him on, you know, CNN or MSNBC. He was on CNN one time during the run up to the Iraq War, and they never had him back on after he basically said that, you know, the Iraq War was a war crime. He was on Bill Maher one time, you know, in the entire history of real time, and was never allowed back on. I don't know why he's, you know, gets the rap that he does, that he's considered, you know, a controversial figure. He definitely, you know, does have, and at times employs some hyperbolic rhetoric, but for the most part, it's pretty difficult to disagree with his analysis of the abuses of power and the manner in which American foreign policy is conducted. So anyway, and also he, you know, his background is he's a linguistics professor at MIT, and he revolutionized the field of linguistics. So he's also got that going for him. But so in this interview, you know, the question might come up is the why did he grant this interview? And basically, it's because he's an incredibly nice guy. But it also has to do with the fact that he will write back anybody who will email him. I hear that he spends 4 to 5 hours a day emailing people back. And, you know, as long as you ask him a coherent question, you will almost certainly get a response from him. So I had sort of built up a relationship with him through email over the years and had tried to interview him before, and it just never worked out with his schedule. But finally, decided to grant one this year. Got to the interview, went about 40 minutes long, and I just want to point out there's a couple of things in the interview that I perhaps did not provide the proper context for, so just want to quickly explain what those things were about. I asked him about a lawsuit that he's involved with. He's a plaintiff in a lawsuit that Chris Hedges filed. He and Daniel Ellsberg and a few others are members of this lawsuit. It's Hedges v. Obama. Chris Hedges filed it against the Obama administration and concerns for the National Defense Authorization Act, specifically the sections in the NDAA that refer to and codify indefinite detention. There are ambiguous sections in there that could possibly allow for the indefinite detention of American citizens. Chomsky's concern is more broad than that. He thinks that, you know, no one should be, able to be detained indefinitely. But the scope of this lawsuit has to do with the sections of the NDAA that refer specifically to Americans. So, you know, when you hear me ask him about that, that's what that's in reference to. The other thing that people might know is that I ask him about the case of Abdullah Haider Shay, who was a Yemeni journalist that is currently being detained in Yemen. Real quickly, this story is on December 17th, 2009, there was an airstrike in Yemen that killed 40-something people. 21 were women, You know, like, I think 11 were children, or maybe more than that, 14 were children, I believe, and there are some claims that up to 4 of the women were pregnant. This airstrike was originally applauded by the Obama administration. It was the first strike in Yemen since 2002, I believe, and we had... it was claimed that this was a Yemeni airstrike, that the President Saleh's government had conducted this airstrike. But when Amnesty International went to investigate this, they were able to look through the rubbish and see that this was a Tomahawk cruise missile that it struck, along with cluster bombs, and Yemen does not have Tomahawk cruise missiles. And then also with the WikiLeaks cables that were released, Amnesty International was able to confirm that this was, in fact, a U.S. strike that hit this village, that apparently they were going after some militant, and they, you know, killed a lot of other people in the process. Well, there was a Yemeni journalist that was also covering this, that was doing a really good job in covering a lot of this information and reporting on this, and his name was Abdullah Haider Shay. And he also was considered a very good resource on AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who has a very strong presence in the south of Yemen. And this was in the Abyan province, in the coastal region where the strike hit in 2009, December 17th. So, anyway, after reporting on this, Shay was arrested by Yemeni officials and put on trial and was accused of collaborating with AQAP. Human Rights Watch did some work on this and followed the trial and said that it was basically a sham trial, kangaroo court. And they threw Shay in jail, and on these what seemed to be trumped up charges. Well, last year President Saleh was going to pardon Shay and release him, and President Obama personally called Saleh and strongly recommended for Shay not to be released. Apparently, it is the position of the Obama administration that Shay was involved with AQAP, although no credible evidence has been released about this. So it's a pretty egregious case. If Shay was involved with AQAP, give us the evidence. Let us see it. Right now, there's not the proper transparency here, and he certainly did not receive a fair trial. So when I mentioned that case to Chomsky, that is the context and background of that case. Other than that, everything else to be pretty self-explanatory. So, Mike, you want to say anything here?
Hi, Mom!
All right, guys. Hope you enjoy the interview, and here is the exclusive interview with Noam Chomsky. Thanks. Take care. Okay, well, good morning, and I appreciate you taking this time to talk to us. I'm sure you're pressed for time, so I'll go ahead and proceed. You are a plaintiff in the Chris Hedges lawsuit versus the Obama administration concerning the National Defense Authorization Act. I was wondering if you could maybe give us an update on that lawsuit. And
the lawsuit is about a pretty narrow issue. One part of the NDAA authorizes indefinite detention without trial and without judicial review, and it authorizes it openly for the part that is controversial is that it authorizes it for American citizens, was that the government refused to answer a question by the judge, repeated questions, asking whether the particular plaintiffs, those who had brought the suit, Chris Hedges and me, others, whether we would be subject to the to these provisions, and the government refused to answer that. So the case was was overturned on those grounds. But the Obama administration immediately brought it back to higher courts, and that's where it stands now. It's waiting for an appeals court.
Do you anticipate that it might reach the Supreme Court?
It might, and I suspect that with Obama's near fanaticism about maximizing executive power, it will probably win, could win at the Supreme Court with the right-wing justices.
You had mentioned that the government refused to answer the question about whether the indefinite detention could apply to journalists. Why do you think they would refuse?
They refused to answer whether it applied to the specific plaintiffs on this appeal.
I see.
There are half a dozen of us. They wouldn't ask whether answer whether we would be subject to this.
Well, why do you think they refused to answer that? Do you think in the appeals and the higher court that they will be compelled to make that argument in court?
Well, it depends. You know, depends which appeals court it goes to. The appeals court of the District of Columbia is very reactionary, and I presume they'll bring it there, and they're likely to side with the government. They usually do, in which case it would probably go to the Supreme Court if they'll take it.
And you have hopes that you would be able to, that the case would win in the Supreme Court.
Well, I think it's important to establish the principle. I don't know what will happen in the Supreme Court. I'm skeptical, but I think it's quite important to establish the principle that we are not overthrowing 800 years of law. As I said, I don't think there should be a distinction between citizens and non-citizens, but you know, at least this much.
Well, you know, we learned yesterday that Fox News reporter James Rosen in the leak case involving Stephen Kim was labeled by the DOJ as a co-conspirator. And this, you know, in the wake of the AP scandal and this administration's unprecedented use of the Espionage Act to crack down on whistleblowers and things like the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. What do you think, what is the deal with this administration, and why do you think they're so aggressive on these issues of freedom of the press and free speech?
It's an interesting question. Frankly, I never expected much of Obama. I wrote about him quite critically even before the 2008 primaries, and nothing that's happened since surprised me very much. Except for this, I do not understand why they are taking such an aggressive stand and trying to undermine fundamental civil liberties. I don't see any political gain in it. It just doesn't seem to have. It has no rational motivation that I can see. Just somehow a desire to extend the power of the executive branch.
Do you think people should be concerned?
Oh, very much so. Not just with this, but with lots of other things. So, first of all, there are things like, say, the use of drones first as a terror weapon. The drones, remember, do not, they're described here as if they kill somebody surgically. That's not true. I suppose wherever you live, when you're walking down the street, you don't know
Faria Amos Lumi.
What he pointed out is that in this village, for years, the jihadi radical Islamist groups had been trying to turn the villagers against the United States, but they didn't succeed. All they knew about the United States was what he wrote to them, and he liked things here, so he's writing them positive accounts. But he said with one drone attack, Obama achieved what the jihadis had failed to do in 2 years. Now, of course, everybody in the village hates the United States, exactly as we would do if bombs were going off right in front of us.
Right.
And that's happening all over big areas.
Have you followed the Abdullah Haider Shay case, the Yemeni journalist who was...
Yeah.
Yeah, why do you think... I mean, I know the Obama administration claims that, you know, he was involved with AQAP and pushed for...
Well, whatever they claim, they have no evidence. I mean, there is a system of law that, as I said, goes back 800 years. Foundation of Anglo-American law, which says in those days, the king, the executive, cannot... that somebody's guilty and punish him. It has to go through due process based on the presumption of innocence, meaning that the government has to prove in a court of law before a jury of peers that the charges actually hold. That's the foundation of law, no? And it doesn't matter what Obama says.
So what do you think would be a more appropriate way for, Washington to deal with terrorist cells in other countries? What is in respect to human rights and due process, what is a way to fight this war? Is there a way to do that? So what would have been the appropriate way to apprehend him? What if what if they had concerns that the Pakistani government was not going to cooperate?
United States is the most feared and
so then should, I mean, if they do end up with situations like that where they can't go through the normal channels to apprehend someone, I mean, should they leave them be?
Extradition.
But what if they can't get it?
Well, let's try.
Yeah.
In the case of the invasion of Afghanistan, on October 7th, Bush, 2001, Bush started bombing Afghanistan. The Afghan government, he had demanded that the Taliban, the Afghan government, hand over Osama bin Laden. They asked for evidence. I mean, somebody asked the U.S. to extradite somebody, but we'd insist that they give evidence. The U.S. refused to give any evidence. The Taliban indicated, they didn't make it explicit, that they might be open to some kind of international trial. The U.S. just disregarded it and went ahead and bombed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are procedures that can be followed. If they don't work, well, then you're stuck. We don't know that they're not going to work. And as I say, we would never, for one second, tolerate anything like this being done against us or against any of our allies.
So why do you think we're so, apprehensive to go about doing things through the proper channels and the proper legal procedures? Well,
that comes from hundreds of years of tradition, after all. Look, after all, we have a history. The colonists came over. It was not traditional imperialism. It was settler colonialism. All the English offshoots, United States, Canada, Australia, so the settlers came over, and they either expelled or exterminated the indigenous populations.
Do you think that that's at the heart of it? I mean, is this the typical machinations of state power, or is there something unique about Americans that, or is it just the situation that they've found themselves in? Why do you think that is?
Because we're very powerful and very highly secure.
Right.
I mean, the U.S. has controlled, pretty much controlled the hemisphere.
Do you think there's, you know, everyone keeps predicting the rise of China and the slow decline of the American empire. Do you think there's any truth to that? Do you see any changes coming in the future? Do you think these coming changes will, you know, make future presidents look more in the mirror at American policies? Do you see change coming from the... Shifting gears a little bit to Iraq, you had mentioned that the war pretty much had destroyed the country. This year marked the 10th anniversary. You know, not wanting to relitigate the run up and the mistakes that happened during, but just looking at 10 years later now, you know, can we is there anything good we can say? You know, 10 years on, you know, compared to before the invasion.
In Iraq, Northern
Well, so then how, in respect to that, how should the international community deal with, you know, despotic, you know, rulers, with the Saddam Husseins of the world? Is there such thing as a legitimate humanitarian intervention? So then what should the international community do about, you know, dictators that are oppressing the people and doing horrible things?
Now
Well, but would there be, like, for example, during the Rwandan genocide, would there have been an appropriate way to have a humanitarian effort in cases like that?
In the case of Rwanda, well, first of all, in the case of Rwanda, if we're serious about it, we should look back a little bit. This didn't begin in the 1990s. Actually, I was writing about it in the 1970s. I have an article with a colleague in retirement, appeared in 1979, which was about the Hutu-Tutsi slaughter. It happened to be in Burundi at the time, but it's the same conflict. So it was known. You know, you knew it years earlier, and nothing was done about it. In the 1980s, Rwanda was subjected to quite a harsh structural adjustment program by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which has, in many other cases, just devastated the country and exacerbated tensions and conflicts, ethnic and other conflicts. And that helped set the stage for the renewal of the Hutu-Tutsi atrocities in the early 90s. And that's what we call the Rwanda genocide. Well, you know, there's a lot that preceded and a lot could have been done beforehand. Once it started, the French who were there asked for small reinforcements, which probably could have put down the atrocities pretty quickly, and they weren't sent.
Why do you think they weren't sent? What about the classic example that everyone loves to bring up, that the Allies had to stop the Axis powers? I mean, do you consider that a just war?
Same story. The time to stop Hitler was in the late 1930s, when it could have been done. You know, 1937, 38, Hitler didn't have the military force to carry out conquests. But instead of trying to stop him, the British and the Americans cooperated with them. I mean, Britain particularly, you know, trade with Germany was very high. It's called appeasement now, but
Well, okay. Wrapping up here, I just you mentioned earlier about the Yemeni activist, I believe it was Faria al-Muslimi, who spoke at that Senate hearing on drones. It was the first Senate hearing that they've had on this issue. Do you see? I mean, it was obviously probably a step in the right direction, but do you see any hope that Obama famously once said that he wants Congress to rein him in if he oversteps. Do you see any hope that, you know, for something like maybe a new church committee or Congress to, you know, be performing their oversight capacities?
Well, I wish I did, but all that we see is the Republican Party, which has, you know, the last 10 or 20 years has just abandoned any pretense of being a normal parliamentary party. They're just using these things as a way to destroy the childish and ridiculous fashion to try to undermine the administration. That's not an investigation. It's not like the Church Committee, which is a serious investigation.
So you see no hope of any meaningful congressional oversight over Obama's foreign policy?
Only if there's a major popular reaction. There's a lot of popular opposition, but it hasn't reached the point where it influences policy.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Professor Chomsky. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. Good talk to you.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
Boom goes London, boom Perry. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round will just be another American town. Oh, how peaceful it will be. We'll set everybody free. Wear a Japanese kimono, baby, be Italian shoes for me. They all hate us anyhow. So let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one now.